the last time I saw a cable television station attempt to portray a biblical story, it was about Sodom and Gomorrah, and they were trying to explain why Sodom and Gomorrah was destroyed. And their answer was, aliens from outer space. Well, this week, there was another program on, this time on the History Channel, about the Bible. We're going to talk about that on this Thursday, March the 7th, in the year of our Lord 2013. And to help us talk about that, we have with us the Reverend Wes Reimnitz. Hi, Wes.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, I'm doing pretty good. What was your general reaction and response to the first part in the series on the Bible?
Well, initial reaction is it's the Reader Digest version of the Bible. You know, the Reader's Digest takes a series of articles out of magazines and condenses them for your reading and things like that, hopefully getting to the point. But in this series, it starts out with Noah talking about creation and then jumping after that to another story, and then after that jumping another 50 to 100 years. So it, artistically, I suppose you could do that, but it jumps around with the story is what it does. And
there's no way they're going to be able to do the entire Old Testament point by point. I can understand
absolutely.
That. The thing that surprised me, because I wasn't expecting any accuracy at all, is how accurate it was in a number of places. We'll get to the inaccuracies in a moment. But when Noah was talking about the creation of the world, it was right out of Genesis 1. Well, and there wasn't the slightest hint of evolution, was there?
No. No. The dialogue was almost verbatim, pretty close.
What I always look for is what the theme is on the part of the people who are doing this. And there were some words that were on the screen prior to the event beginning, and it really showed me what their main goal was. And here's what it said. I don't know if you'll remember this, but the film endeavors to stay with the spirit of the book. Now, what does that mean? And the word spirit wasn't capitalized, so it's not the Holy Spirit of the book, but the spirit of the book.
The general gist, I suppose, kind of an idea of where the book is headed.
I would say that, for example, is there some noise going on there?
No.
Oh, okay, we can hear something going on. I'm going to shut you down for a minute. I can understand why somebody would say that it's not an accurate representation, but when we talk about Lutheranism, the spirit of the book means that it's all about Jesus. So, Wes, how many times was Jesus mentioned?
I didn't hear once.
You are absolutely correct. Is there a significant portion where Jesus should have been mentioned, because the Bible even speaks of him, where it didn't occur?
Well, now you go back to the creation account with Noah and the fall of mankind and Adam and Eve in the garden, that none of that was mentioned. You know, that's interesting when you bring up Jesus isn't talked about. The fall of mankind into sin and the whole incident of God's promise that one day a Messiah would come was not mentioned.
Yes. There was also, what does the Bible say about who opened the Red Sea?
Yes. We talked about that earlier, but in Peter Krause's book, Angel of Angels, We had studied it in the Bible class, that it was the angel of the Lord that caused that to open up.
And was he apparent in the movie at all, anywhere?
No, it wasn't. In fact, that was quite interesting that you bring that up, because I went back and looked in Exodus, and the angel of the Lord, we're told, went behind the people of Israel with the pillar of the cloud. You know, it was cloud and fire.
And that was to separate the Egyptians from the Israelites.
Exactly.
That didn't appear either in the film, did it?
No. No, that was not in the film. And in fact, when you go into that whole Exodus account there, it even talks about how God caused their chariots when they were out in the Red Sea to wobble around and they couldn't get anywhere. That wasn't brought out.
Yes. What I think is what we're talking about is when you first think about that, you would think they would be against the supernatural. But I have to say that when the Red Sea was divided, I thought they did a pretty good job about the miraculous way in which it was done, because there were two walls of water. You know, there's some people who say that actually was ice, you know, trying to explain how the water stood up. But God said himself that he sent a wind which kept the two walls of water up, but the wind obviously didn't reach near the sand of the sea, because the people could walk through.
In fact, we're told that it was dry ground as they went across the bottom.
Well said. That's right. It was dry ground. And that was another thing that kind of bothered me. They saw the Egyptians coming, and they're rushing them within eyesight with chariots that are going really fast. And so the Red Sea then opens up, and they begin to run through. I mean, the Israelites are running through the Red Sea. We know there were 600,000 men, not counting women and children. So there were probably about 1 million people. And to cross the Red Sea would have taken more than the 4 minutes that they allowed the Egyptians to catch up with them. And there was no pillar of fire or pillar of cloud stopping them from attacking the Israelites.
Is that what you call Hollywood magic?
Well, I don't know what you would call it. What we're trying to do right now is just show that you've got to be really careful with this, because there's a number of things. You know, what was so sad, there is so much dialogue in the Bible. Why they had to add to it is beyond me. The first time they did it, did you notice how argumentative was Lot's wife?
Yes. Yeah, I do remember that. And in fact, the angels show up scared at Lot's door.
Yeah, they're already beaten up. They're already bloody and beaten up. These angels, and by the way, they're the same two angels that met with Abraham with that third person who is never identified in the film, and we know he is
the angel of the Lord.
Who is?
Jesus.
Yes.
Incarnated.
Yeah, Jesus pre-incarnate.
Yes.
Yeah, he's not incarnated yet.
No, pre.
Yeah. So the angels, they're the ones that are sent to Sodom and Gomorrah. And what really bothers me, I want to share, and I was kind of going through the Bible as they were looking at this. In Genesis 19:11, it explains how the angels stopped the attack against Lot and his family. It says, And they struck the men who were at the doorway of the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they became weary trying to find the door. And then they say to Lot, have you anyone else here? Take them out of this place. Now, what instead did the movie show?
Well, the movie showed that that they were fighting with them. They blinded them, and then the soldiers, almost like in a samurai manner, pulls out a couple of swords and starts fighting with the townspeople.
And it looked like I was watching one of those karate practices with the angels jumping around and putting to death a number of people by the sword. There is nothing like that in the Bible.
No.
They simply blinded them, they couldn't find the door, and then they kind of left. What did you think about Lot's wife being changed into a pillar of salt? Was that done properly?
I had left the room about that time.
Oh.
Came back, and then they...
Oh, okay. Yes, I think it was. She's walking, and unfortunately the family is behind her. And so, you know, there's fire coming out of heaven and brimstone. And so she turns around in the movie to look at the family, and she turns into salt. Whereas the Bible is pretty clear that she turns around to look at the city that the angel warned them not to look at.
Oh, yeah. That would have been very, yeah.
So that that's another thing that it was just kind of interesting there. Then we move on to Abraham in Genesis 22, verse 3. And this is really the wonderful experience Abraham had in being tested by God in order to put Isaac to death. But verse 2 says, God says, "Take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I tell you." Now, the next verse does not say, "And Abraham began to argue with God."
Yeah.
The very next verse says,
"Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey,
and took two of his young men with him and his son Isaac." There was no arguing at all, but in the film, there was arguing.
Yeah, and, you know, the other thing was, it was on the third day that Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. So they traveled 3 days to get where they were going to do the sacrifice.
And why is that significant in contrast to the movie?
Well, in the movie, it almost sounds like it's in the backyard, and Sarah is able to get there in time when the sacrifice doesn't happen.
Yeah, it was almost like a comedy. Somehow, Sarah came to a realization that Abraham was going to kill Isaac. Now, it doesn't say why she came to that, but because Abraham said they were going up to sacrifice. In fact, in verse 5, this is really important, with the young men that he had brought with him, he says, "Stay here with the donkey. The lad and I will go yonder and worship, and we will come back to you."
Yeah.
So there is no indication whatsoever that these men had any inkling that Isaac would be the one sacrificed.
And I don't think Sarah would have either.
No, I think you're absolutely correct there. But the movie has her suddenly realizing this and then begins running up the hill that's right out, like you said, the backyard. And just as she gets near it, there comes Abraham at the top of the hill, and she breaks down in crying. And then right behind him comes Isaac, and she yells at Isaac, you know.
Right.
So, what we need to recall here, therefore, is that Isaac is somebody that is going to be in the promise. Now, why would Abraham say, and we're getting back to the Bible here, to these young men, that "we will come back to you" if he knows he's going to sacrifice Isaac?
Well, in verse 8, Abraham said, "God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son." And that's Abraham talking to his son Isaac. He kept trusting in the promises that God had made to him.
That's true, but he did, at that point, suppose the sacrifice was Isaac.
Right.
Yeah, it really wasn't. Now, how could Abraham possibly think that after he killed Isaac, and by the way, the knife is something that begins the sacrifice. What really happens is that Isaac is now going to be burned up.
Right.
So how could he, was he just telling that to the young men, or was there something else going on?
Well, I would believe then that he believed that God could raise his son even if his son was destroyed.
That is excellent. In fact, you know what you're doing? You're quoting Hebrews 11, verse 19. Let me read 17 through 19. "By faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, In Isaac your seed shall be called. Now listen to verse 19. Accounting that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he had also received him in a figurative sense. What's that last part mean?
The figurative sense that he was, even though he was dead, he would be made alive.
But he had received him in a figurative sense. Remember, what was also dead? The womb of Sarah.
Sarah, yes, that's right.
He had already seen that God could bring life from a dead womb. That's what verse 19 is talking about. And therefore he accounted, okay, I will kill my son, but God will bring him back to life. And that's why he said to the young men, we will return to you.
Okay.
Was any of that depth found in the movie?
No. They played off of the emotions back and forth. And they got Isaac weeping, Dad, don't do this.
That's another good point you make there, Wes, because there's certain things I've never seen done in movies properly. The one would be the blind man that Jesus heals by telling him to go to the Pool of Siloam. And you can only imagine, because from the temple to the pool was a distance. Here's this guy with his eyes caked in mud, blind, hobbling through the streets. I'm sure somebody would say to him, Fred, or whatever his name was, what are you doing? And then he would say, well, this man told me to go wash in the Pool of Siloam. I mean, I don't know how they would televise that, so it made sense. And this is the other event that I've often wondered about. How did Abraham get his son Isaac on the altar? What did the movie show?
He bound his hands and...
With Isaac's cooperation?
Yeah, not so much with his cooperation.
Not at all.
Yeah.
And Isaac was there saying, no, no, no. I saw one other movie. You know how they did it? It was great. Abraham told Isaac that he was the one to be sacrificed, and Isaac fainted.
Okay.
And Abraham just picked him up and put him on and bound him on the altar.
Well, it also raises the question, how old was Isaac?
Well, he had to be old enough to be carrying the wood on a trip, so probably a teenager or something along that lines.
And I don't think they've portrayed him as a teenager.
Well, he wasn't that much older. I thought he was a lad.
Yeah, he was, but there again, I don't know who I was reading. They thought maybe he might have been as old as 20 years of age.
Yeah, there's no evidence in the Bible for that at all.
Right.
You know, speculation. But I once did a sermon about this. You know what the title was? It was The Faith of Isaac.
Hmm.
And I assumed that when Abraham told him he was to be sacrificed, that he obeyed his father and allowed himself to be bound. But that's somewhat of speculation also. But he had great faith. There was no doubt about that. Then we get to Moses getting back to Pharaoh's palace.
Oh, you're going to skip Israel going into Egypt?
Well, that was just real short, you know, because of the famine. And
they said it was because of the famine, but I looked it up, and that's not why they went down.
Oh, go ahead.
You know, if you read there I think it's Genesis 45, God is talking to Jacob in a dream and says to him, go down to Egypt, and I will make your nation great. So it's God telling Jacob to go down to there, or 46, I should say. And also in 45, the Pharaoh's house invites them to take over the best land of Egypt. So you get two things going on there.
Well, in verse 6 of 45, and that was I was following, for these 2 years the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting. And God sent me before you to preserve a posterity for you in the earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So
that is, who's saying that though?
God.
God. But it's also Joseph talking to his brothers.
Right, right. Yeah, but he's giving the message from God.
God, right.
So the famine was the thing God put in place to get them down there. and then to survive their posterity, then they had the 450 years. So anyway, Moses is in Pharaoh's palace, and the killing is really ridiculous. Remember, Moses kills one of the Egyptians, and he hides the body, according to Exodus 2:3. But according to the movie, one of the slaves takes the body away. And then he flees, of course, and when he comes back, he meets the son of Pharaoh that he had big arguments with before he left. But unfortunately, in Exodus, it makes very clear that everybody had died who was looking to put Moses to death.
Yeah. In fact, it says, go back to Egypt, for all the men that were seeking your life are dead.
Exactly. So Pharaoh, of course, doesn't like Moses because he had seen him trying to usurp the throne that he should have had. And when he goes in, the Bible talks about the rod becomes a snake, but none of that occurred, did it?
No.
Instead, Pharaoh has his soldiers kind of beat up Moses and Aaron and throws them out. No serpents at all.
Yeah. In fact, in my Wednesday morning Bible class, they were disappointed because they didn't get to see all the plagues.
Yeah, there were a few of the plagues, and they went by real fast, like frogs in the bed, and Pharaoh is swimming in the Nile, I guess, and it all of a sudden it turns to blood. I could see they have a license there where if they're not going to emphasize that part, they would, you know, kind of do the Reader's Digest version, so to speak.
Right.
But there's a lot more I could say about this, but our time is running out. So what I do want to say is, I'll give you my impression, then I'll ask you for yours, is that the main reason all this was written, according to Paul in the New Testament, was for us as an example of how we need to not do what they did, which was tempting Christ again and again. So even when they were about to go through the Red Sea, they were angry at Moses. Then they went through the Red Sea. Then the Egyptians were chasing them, and they got angry at Moses, God, again. And there was none of the Christian message in the middle of this, even though it's obviously found throughout the Old Testament. So just be aware, they're looking at this as kind of the spirit of the book. I take to mean, therefore, these are kind of fables. They probably really didn't happen this way, but at least we're giving you an account as close as we think. But the added dialogue really takes away and contradicts the Bible also in a number of places. What's your final word on this?
I would agree with you. It takes away the pointing to Jesus. Or, you know, In, as I hear you recounting this, also talking about how the people were often tested by God.
Yes.
As Abraham was tested in that sacrifice. And in 1 Corinthians, where it talks about no temptation shall overtake you.
Yeah, 1 Corinthians 10:13. We're not going to be able to get to that today.
Yeah.
I'll talk about that tomorrow.
But yeah, you'll talk about that tomorrow, but still, how the Lord always presents those ways out, and especially, we talked about it several times, the angel of the Lord, which is Christ pre-incarnate, and shows up, and also the message of Christ, the fall of mankind, and the message of hope that was given to God's people.
Yes.
And Noah's Ark. You know, baptism now saves you, which we find from 1 Peter. You know, there's just so many different parts, I would say, from that angle. I think the Passover could have been done a lot more emphasis that would have pointed to the fact that Christ was going to be, you know, the firstborn. And it's going to be interesting to see later in the movie how much that's brought forward.
Well, the next time that Christ appears for sure is they can begin complaining against them not having water, and so a rock is struck, which begins to follow them, and the Apostle Paul says that rock was Christ.
Christ, yes.
And I'll bet you you're not going to hear that. You know, it showed me once more how important it really is to get a Christian point of view when we're even reading the Old Testament. Because if you just stay with the Old Testament and don't see how the interpretation in the New Testament goes back to it, you're missing Christ again and again.
You know, you would probably say that instead of the movie, you would recommend that they read the book.
Well, I would do that, but, you know, Mel Gibson did a movie on the Passion. And yeah, right from the beginning, remember, the serpent, and who puts his foot on the serpent's head? Jesus.
Jesus, yeah.
So that's a way you can put this together. Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. I'll continue this tomorrow on Open Mic Friday, as well as the hymn, and maybe something on 1 Corinthians 10:13. Your services this Sunday?
At 7:45 and 10:15. We're on the radio at 7:45 on WDUC.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Wes Reinitz. God bless.
Listen to Law and Gospel on KFUO Radio. You can write Pastor Tom at KFUO Radio, 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. Or email lawgospel@lawgospel.com. Law and Gospel is archived for your listening convenience at KFUO.org.